From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
There is a bear in the woods. For some people, the bear is easy to see. Others don't see it at all.
That ad from Ronald Reagan's 1984 re-election campaign is one of the greatest American political ads ever, according to Neil Oxman. Oxman is a veteran political media consultant. His company has made ads for over 700 campaigns. Today, Oxman discusses campaign media strategy and how things can go wrong.
TV stations make mistakes and they run the wrong ads. That happens all the time. And oh my Lord, an attack ad is running and you don't want it to run. I mean, it's literally like starting a nuclear war because somebody making $12 an hour at a TV station pressed the wrong button.
Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the New Pornographers, and Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel 1004 by Ben Lerner. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A recent analysis by the New York Times found that this year's congressional elections will generate more than $2 billion worth of political advertising on television. Our guest, Neil Oxman, has been making political ads for more than 30 years. He's a co-founder of the Campaign Group, a Philadelphia-based media firm that's managed ad campaigns in more than 700 races around the country. The firm's clients range from local office seekers to candidates for the House, Senate, and in a few cases, the presidency. Oxman has made ads for Al Gore and for Jerry Springer when he was a mayor of Cincinnati running for governor. Oxman's also managed to fit an interesting hobby into his life, working as a caddy on the Pro Golf Tour. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies sat down with Neil Oxman to talk about how he makes political ads, what works and what doesn't, and how the business has changed since he got into it decades ago.
Neil Oxman, welcome to Fresh Air. You've done hundreds of elections. I've heard you say that in pretty much every campaign, there are three things you have to do.
The three things that you want to try to do in a campaign, if you're running a perfect campaign, is define yourself, meaning you define the candidate before your opponent defines him or herself. The second is define your opponent before the opponent defines himself or herself. And the third thing is you define the stakes of the election. You make the election about something most beneficial to you. Sometimes the stakes of the election are defined by major national issues. The Watergate year of 1974, the contract with America year of 1994, it's the economy stupid of 1992. I mean, there are seminal years in American politics where something is going on, and if you're in one party or the other, you might get wiped out or you might win regardless of what you do. The stakes of the election, if you can define it and make the campaign about something you want to make it about, is the best thing to do.
Sometimes it's not so obvious. I want to play an example of an ad that you brought, and I think this is a good example of an ad that defines the stakes. And this is an ad for Ronald Reagan. I guess probably this was in 1984.
His reelection with Walter Mondale.
And it's about a bear. Why don't you just, before we listen to it, why don't you describe the visual? What's happening?
Ad done by this amazing ad guy, now passed away in California, named Hal Riney. You would know Hal Riney because he also did a lot of voiceover commercials. He did them for Gallo Wine. He did them for Alamo Rent-A-Car. I mean, he had this amazing voice. He's the guy who said in the Reagan commercials in 1984, "It's morning again in America." And he made, I think, one of the two greatest ads in American history, the first being Tony Schwartz's ad with the Daisy and Lyndon Johnson in 1964, which only ran once. And this ad where, in a sort of very low tone, you hear the opening line that says, "There's a bear in the woods." And it's simply a picture of a bear and a hunter in silhouette. And the hunter has probably a shotgun. And the bear obviously represents Russia. Or communism, or the Soviet threat. And it's a vague reference to that, but it's really a way of saying Reagan was strong and Mondale wasn't strong about our national defense.
The fascinating thing is you see the bear moving around open terrain, and at the end he comes face to face with a hunter who does not level a weapon at him.
No,
and
he
the
does
question
not.
Is he prepared? Let's listen to this ad.
"There is a bear in the woods. For some people, the bear is easy to see. Others don't see it at all. Some people say the bear is tame. Others say it's vicious and dangerous. Since no one can really be sure who's right, isn't it smart to be as strong as the bear? If there is a bear."
And I believe at the end of the ad, there's a card that says Ronald Reagan prepared for peace. And I mean, it was, I think, one of the two most brilliant ads made in the 60-year history of American political advertising.
I want to play an ad that you did for a mayor's race here in Philadelphia in 2007 for Michael Nutter, who is still the mayor of the city. And this was a race where you didn't run any negative ads, if I recall, except you might have criticized the previous mayor, because I think you defined the stakes in that election as to who will take a different direction. Let's just listen to the ad for a moment.
"My name is Olivia Nutter.
This is my dad.
This is a house my dad grew up in West Philadelphia.
This is our dog.
This is my favorite food.
My dad's pretty cool for an old guy.
This is where I go to middle school.
My dad's the only Democrat for mayor with a child in the public schools.
I know he wants to make them better and safer.
My dad's pretty busy these days. but he still finds time to take me to school.
Have a good day. Yep. Be good.
The daughter of the candidate is the only voice, other than a brief mention of the mayor. Tell us your approach there.
Well, I saw Olivia and I thought, I'm going to use her in a spot somehow. And I wrote on my little pink message pad just her name. And then I wrote some copy and I ran it by Michael and the current mayor. And Nutter was in last place in a five-way primary. He was – the leader in the campaign was in the 30s and he was dead last at 7% of the vote with the least amount of money. And none of the candidates were sort of making the campaign about anything particularly relevant. And we decided to make the campaign a referendum on who would be least like the mayor who was there then, a guy named John Street. And we ran a couple of weeks of TV, and we moved from last to second. But we were having a problem with African-American females who weren't connecting with – for some reason with Nutter. I could never figure out why. Michael Nutter is an African-American. And so we ran this ad, and when we did, he went into the lead and started doing overwhelmingly better with African-American females and won that quadrant of the vote very handily. Coincidentally, the guy who ran that campaign, Bill Hires, who did a terrific job, then ran Bill de Blasio's campaign for mayor in New York City last year, who came from behind and used his son in an ad, which is largely credited with getting de Blasio elected mayor. I don't know whether they stole our ad. I won't say they did. I think David Axelrod's firm did it. And nothing is original after the 1950s in political advertising, or 60s, I should say. So, but it really did work.
Everybody looks at everybody else's stuff. Now, you said that in the case of that ad, you needed to boost Nutter's standing among African-American women. How much of what you do in designing and messaging ads is driven by polls and research?
All of it, if you're smart. I mean, I don't mean that you take a poll and if somebody's – you can't do what Romney did. You can't just take a poll and sort of remake yourself. I mean, here's Mitt Romney, who was pro-choice and pro-environment and pro-health care and governed like a liberal in Massachusetts and ran as a liberal and governed as a liberal and then wake up one day and say, I'm going to run for president and completely disband that. We don't take polls to tell a candidate what to do, what you know, to change his opinion or her opinion about certain things. We take polls to sort of emphasize in certain areas. I mean, if you're running for governor of a state and the state is rural and urban, you're not necessarily running spots about farms in the urban part of the state. I mean, you have to be somewhat smart about that. But what we try to do with ads is A, have the right message, meaning we're saying the right things, and B, of course, target that message to the right group of people.
You know, I don't see many ads in which candidates speak directly into the camera. And I would imagine that when you talk to candidates, a lot of them think they're pretty impressive people one-on-one and probably want to do that. When do you let a candidate talk into the camera?
If the candidate is good. I mean, because there are tricks you can do. You can have the candidate start talking and then you can cut away and use that as an audio edit or use that as a video edit if for some reason the candidate has blinked or looked weirdly into the monitor or whatever it is. And we do it. You're going to laugh at this, but we did Jerry Springer's campaign for governor of Ohio. Now, Jerry Springer was a young idealistic mayor of Cincinnati who got in trouble because he went into a house of ill repute in northern Kentucky and passed a check and got
he
drunk.
Paid for the services with a check.
Yes. But he runs for governor, and my friend Mike Ford hired us. Michael Ford had just passed away, who was a great political operative in the United States. I mean, one of the giants in this business, was running his campaign for governor of Ohio. And Michael said to my producer, Mark Moskowitz, this guy can really talk to the camera, but no one knows it. And most of the spots we had Springer talk to the camera. Well, when the campaign was over, Springer only got 15% of the vote. When the campaign was over, he lost the primary. The TV station in Cincinnati said to Springer, do you want to do editorial comments for us? And they said yes. And he started doing those, and they made him the anchor. And that from there, he got a regional talk show, and from there, he became Jerry Springer. Literally because he talked to the camera in spots that we made for him in a losing gubernatorial campaign in Ohio in 1982, I think it was.
We're speaking with Neil Oxman. He's the founder of the Campaign Group and a veteran of making political ads. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, our guest is veteran political consultant Neil Oxman. He is the founder of the Campaign Group. They've made political ads for over 700 campaigns over the last several decades. So as a campaign proceeds, things can get tough. Are there typical arguments you get into with a candidate about a media strategy? I mean, there must be tapes that go over and over in your head.
Mostly about going negative. Mostly about, I want to do the campaign my way. I don't want to have to go negative. I mean, that's really what most of the fights are about. Of course, that immediately changes when you get attacked. And sometimes you don't have any notice. Now, sometimes we get notice because the ad gets trafficked to the TV station and somebody at the TV station, we get lucky and somebody calls us and says, or sometimes actually the campaigns preview the negative ads. But, you know, sometimes we'll get a call from the candidate and the candidate's wife and, you know, it's 7:18 and I'm just watching Jeopardy and they go crazy and that conversation goes entirely out the window. And so, you have to just deal with it.
You brought a couple of other ads. This is an ad attacking Mark Pryor, you explain who he is and who put this ad together.
Mark Pryor is the United States Senator from Arkansas running for re-election. And Karl Rove's independent committee, Crossroads, Karl Rove, who was the political genius behind George Bush and started up an independent committee and supports Republican candidates around the country, produced this ad that's running in Arkansas, or ran in Arkansas this year against Mark Pryor's running for re-election in Arkansas. I think it's a terrific ad.
And it's an ad of a kid at a spelling bee. Right. Let's listen.
Your next word is Pryor.
May I have the definition, please?
Pryor, a Washington liberal out of touch with Arkansas, voted for the Obama agenda 90%.
May I hear it in a sentence?
Mark Pryor was the deciding vote for Obamacare.
Pryor, O-B-A-M-A.
Close enough.
American Crossroads is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Close enough, the judges say. Obama equals Pryor. Effective ad?
It's terrific because when you see it at the beginning, the ad looks exactly like everything you've seen for any spelling bee you've seen on national television or all the movies that do spelling bees. And it's a little girl sitting there and they do it in the exact format. And my guess is, not knowing the polling research, but my guess is that if you polled right now Barack Obama's name in Arkansas, it's obviously very negative, and equaling Mark Pryor to Barack Obama is not a good thing for Mark Pryor. But the effectiveness of the ad is how exactly close the ad looks like a real spelling bee thing. There's no phoniness about it. Really, this is a spelling bee.
So if you're Mark Pryor and that ad comes at you, what would you advise him to do?
That's a really hard ad to respond to, Dave, because the ad is so real. It's not a FACO ad in the sense that it's something in real life. But what you would probably do is you'd probably stop the ad and say, see this ad? These aren't real people. These are actors.
You'd run a piece of that ad and say, hold it, folks.
These aren't real people. These are actors. And this isn't a real spelling bee. And Mark Pryor voted against Obama when he opposed Obama on this and this and this and this and this. Mark Pryor, an independent voice for Arkansas. I don't know if it would work because I thought that ad's one of the most effective ads I've seen in this cycle.
Not bad for a 15-second pitch. When you're doing a campaign, a congressional campaign, a Senate campaign, and somebody unleashes a hard-hitting attack ad on your opponent, is it better to respond by attacking your opponent or by doing an ad defending your candidate?
There's no rule, Dave. Every campaign is different. Every set of circumstances is different. Every part of the country is different. And a lot of it is some of it's science and some of it's poetry. Some of it's prose and poetry. I mean, some of it is where you sort of see where you are in the polls and whether you need to, you know, take a 2x4 and kill the guy or whether you just sort of need to brush your opponent back a little bit and then go to the main message of what you have to talk about.
When you're making a negative ad, a contrastive ad, an attack ad, are there ways to do it that kind of protects your own candidate's reputation a bit, makes them still seem statesmanlike?
Well, it depends on the tone of the ad and the heavy-handedness on the tone of the ad. And, you know, sometimes then you might start with negative,
and then switch to positive so that the ad has kind of a feel-good feeling and you do it that way. You don't want the ad to be so ominous that the ad has to be believable. I mean, what I liked about that Mark Pryor ad that you were talking about is that it's very believable because it's something that everybody sees. You know, you've seen these spelling bee things, and they're very accessible to you. I mean, an ad has to be believable. I mean, some of the ads that you see where Chargers are leveled, they're just so out of the blue and so unbelievable. So-and-so voted essentially not to fund any, you know, missile programs ever. We're all going to die in a nuclear attack tomorrow. I mean, but these exaggerations are so hyperbolic that they're just not believable. So the attacks, what you want to do is make sure when you're doing these attacks that there's credibility to them and there's believability to them. And then sometimes you end an ad with positive. You do a sort of change in tone and end it with positive so that you get a different feeling.
You know, for years now, the media have been analyzing political ads and truth squatting them, right? Well, this claim doesn't quite hold up. That one's a half-truth. If you're in the middle of a campaign and the media criticize the accuracy or fairness of your ad, do you care?
You used to care a lot more than you do now. One of the great tragedies, of course, that's happened in America is the slow demise of the American newspaper, where, you know, if you ran for governor, senator in a state and it was a big state, you'd have dozens of reporters sometimes following a campaign. Now you might have a handful. And so you don't have the same kind of local political coverage. You do in a mayor's race. You do clearly in a presidential campaign. But if you're running for Congress in this country, or you're running for the Senate, or you're running for governor, the kind of scrutiny you get from the free press is not nearly as acute as it used to be. And so sometimes you avoid it. Now, I've had people literally run ads against our clients saying that one of our clients raised taxes, voted to raise taxes in the legislature. Absolutely did not happen. Never voted the other way. The press did do nothing because there's no press covering the campaign. And so, you know, there was no truth squad out there saying this ad of our opponent was wrong. I mean, so you try to do truthful things in campaigns, and you want to make sure that you want to make sure what you're saying in a campaign doesn't come back to haunt you. That's the number one goal of what you want to do. You don't want to become an issue in the campaign.
How has the business changed in the 35 years you've been doing it?
Well, the biggest thing is Citizens United and money. I mean, 30 years ago when we started, a good congressional campaign in any district in America might spend $200,000 on TV. Now a good congressional campaign in place in America spends $2 to $3 million on TV, certainly way beyond the cost of inflation. I mean, unbelievably beyond the cost of inflation, even beyond the cost of way college tuitions have gone up. I mean, the cost of American television has exceeded every year the cost of inflation by many times. So what you used to be able to buy an ad in some media market on the Today Show for X, and now to get less of an audience on the Today Show in the same market cost five times X. So money is the biggest single thing. And then, of course, now it's all the independent expenditures. I don't know whether independent expenditures this year, meaning independent committees raising money away from a campaign itself, the candidates' campaigns themselves, will spend as much money as all the campaigns combined. But we're getting to the point where it's really close, where everybody I know who does this business are doing as much business in their own firms, you know, from independent committees as they are from clients.
So the people who are hiring you to make ads aren't candidates.
No,
often. They are independent committees who are funded
by
unions or corporations or
individuals.
Or ideological.
And exactly, because the reporting rules are a lot different. And it's not about personal money. You can give corporate money. And so if somebody goes to a friend and says, hey, give me $100,000 from your corporation, if it's a privately held corporation, instead of $2,500 from you, and this $100,000 is never going to be reported, that's why so much of this independent money is being raised.
And so if the court decisions now mean there are these independent groups who have a lot of money to put into political advertising, does the character of the advertising itself change? If it's not the candidate putting their name to it, does it mean
it's become much more negative. The ratio of negative to positive has gotten much higher.
Neil Oxman will continue his conversation with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies in the second half of the show. Oxman is a campaign media consultant who has made political ads for more than 30 years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, supporting the Stand Up to Cancer live television event this Friday to help fund innovative cancer research. More at cancercenter.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from Angie's List, offering consumer reviews for more than 19 years and providing online shopping and scheduling for local services. Angie'sList.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews 1004, the new novel by Ben Lerner, which she describes as strange and spectacular. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the New Pornographers, whose members include Nico Case. And we hear more from veteran campaign media consultant Neil Oxman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview that Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with political media consultant Neil Oxman. Oxman is a co-founder of the Campaign Group, which has managed ad campaigns in more than 700 races around the country. When we left off, they were discussing how the business is changing as a result of the Citizens United decision, which enables corporations and unions to spend unlimited money on campaign ads.
It seems what happens, and I've covered some congressional races here, is that when there is a competitive congressional race, outside money floods in and it becomes a nationalized election. We're really not talking exactly about citizens choosing their own representatives. We're talking about national interest groups bombarding people with messaging.
Well, one of the reasons, Dave, is because of the 435 congressional districts in America, very, very few now are really competitive. If you sit and look at the almanac of American politics from 10 years ago and 20 and 30 and 40 years ago, if you just go back for the last 40 years, the almanac, I think, started in 72. There at one point were between 150 and 200 legitimately contested congressional races in America. Now you're down literally to fewer than 50 because of redistricting and reapportionment. And so you have so much money flowing into so few congressional districts. You know, you have 300 congressional districts where not a penny is spent, and you'll have 50 where $5 or $10 million or more is spent on a congressional campaign. What used to be spent on a major statewide campaign is spent on one little race for Congress.
Campaigns can be pretty intense, particularly in the last 2 or 3 weeks. How quickly can you turn around a response ad?
You get attacked. You make a response ad in a relatively few hours, and then you put it up on satellite, and it gets to the TV stations right away. So if you're attacked on a Monday and you find out Monday morning, you can pretty much be Tuesday morning, you can be on with a response ad. The biggest lag time actually is once the ad gets to the TV stations, how quickly they log the ad in at the TV station and they put it in rotation into their sort of commercial cycle. Weekends are really bad, which is why you'll see a lot of attack ads start after noon on Friday, because the weekends often you're not able to respond, and so they get sort of a 48 or 60 free hours before you can respond by Monday.
Because the TV stations are close. Are thinly staffed on weekends.
Absolutely.
And they just can't turn them
and
around.
And they'll tell you that, you know, there's no one there. And the other thing is that some people at the TV stations make mistakes and they run the wrong ads. That happens all the time. They log in the wrong ads. And oh, my Lord, an attack ad is running and you don't want it to run. And you've started out – I mean, it's literally like starting a nuclear war. Somebody's pressed the wrong button. That's literally what's happened. Somebody's pressed the wrong button. It started a gigantic war in the campaign, and you didn't mean to run it because somebody making $12 an hour at a TV station literally put a wrong computer term in, and that was it, the wrong ad ran.
And that's happened in the campaign.
It's happened to us. It's happened to our opponents. It happens all the time.
What you do a lot of is produce 30-second ads, and their 30-second TV ads have been the currency of political campaigns, contested political campaigns for decades now. And, you know, I'm somebody who covers campaigns, and I'm often looking at ads that deal with issues that I know something about, or if I don't know, I make it my business to know something about it. And it's striking how one-sided they are, how ill-informed they sometimes are, how they're distorted or unfair. And I realize that if somebody good wants to get in office and do something good, they got to get elected first, and this is the game they have to play. But I wonder, do you ever feel like, gosh, this is just – we're not doing a very good job of informing our electorate?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I wish there were more debates. That's why I'm for term limits. I'm one of the few Democrats who's for term limits. That's why I wish newspapers still existed. That's why I wish there was much more newspaper coverage of substance in campaigns and not process, meaning how much money a candidate has raised and how who's up and who's down in the polls, because reporters are way into that instead of looking at somebody's jobs plan or what somebody wants to do about taxes. But remember, what we're trying to do is persuasion. We're not doing 5-minute long forms where people are going to sort of fall asleep. We're trying to do persuasion, no different than any other marketing that you see, whether it's for Pepsi or Ford or Coke or anything else.
Are TV ads still the most effective way to move votes?
Yes. I mean, 10 years ago, of course, there was no part of a campaign. I mean, if you looked at a campaign structure from 10 years ago, you had – you know, a campaign manager, and you had a press secretary, and you had an issues director, and you had a scheduler, and you had a field director, and you had a traveling person. Now you have a whole social media department. And so when you looked at a budget from 10 years ago, there was zero money for social media. Now a legitimate percentage of a campaign is spent on everything around social media. But the biggest predictor of voting is age. The second biggest predictor of voting is, of course, income, education. But still in America today, the greatest predictor of how somebody's going to – if somebody's going to vote is how old they are, which is why in presidential campaigns you get 25 or 30 million more people vote than in the non-presidential, because people under 30 just don't come out in these by-elections. And older people watch TV. They're much more passive about how they get their information. They sit in front of the television. They don't flick away from commercials. They watch TV. Kids today don't watch TV on TV. They watch it on every other thing they can get. They watch it on their phones. They watch it on their iPads. They watch it on computers. But television is still, in most campaigns, the largest single expenditure you'll see in that campaign, whether somebody runs for mayor of a big city, Congress, governor, senator, or president, but maybe not president, but at least those statewide offices and Congress will be television and radio expenditures.
So at least for a few more years, people need you.
hopefully.
You have this life in political advertising. You've done this for decades. But you are also a caddy on the pro golf tour. And for years, you've been carrying the bag of the legendary Tom Watson. I mean, a Hall of Fame golfer. How did you get started doing this?
It's the way I earned my way through college and law school. I started caddying in the summer of 1972 when I was in college. I caddied in the golf tournament that came to Philly, and I caddied for a guy, and he said, "What are you doing next week?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Well, come to Cleveland." Caddy before me in the Cleveland Open. And that's how you started. Caddies were making $125 a week and 3% of what a guy won, and the purses were very low. My tuition to college was only $700 a semester, so it actually still did pay for my tuition to college. It was a great way to sort of do it. I've never missed a year caddying since 72.
You haven't stopped. You haven't missed a year since 72.
I've never missed a year caddying at least one tournament. There's only two guys on the tour who have caddied longer than I have. Guys have caddied in more tournaments, but I've caddied almost 500 events on the PGA and Senior Golf Tour. But that's what I did during my way through college and law school. I've essentially, as a friend of mine says, I joined the circus, and I've been able to literally travel around the world being inside the ropes at golf tournaments, which is by far, to paraphrase Bobby Jones's famous acceptance speech of becoming a freeman of the Burger of St. Andrews, that he said he could take everything out of his life except what happened to him at St. Andrews and feel he had a complete life. I feel the same way about caddying. I could take anything else, including politics, out of my life and feel I had an amazing life, but not from my experience as a caddy on the golf tour.
You know, people think of a caddy as somebody who carries a golf bag. There's a lot more to it. What does a caddy do?
Well, depends on the caddy and the relationship. I mean, you know, you watch TV and you see the interplay between Jim Mackay, a.k.a. Bones, and Phil Mickelson, where they're talking almost every shot about every kind of thing that happens. And then there are guys, as I always describe myself to Watson, as just a bag toter. The biggest thing the caddies do is they give the yardage to the hole to the player.
How do you get to know a course that well?
Well, in the old days, you walked the course without a yardage book. Today, there are men who make yardage books. And if you saw the detail of a yardage book, it's really sort of like an architect's drawing of a hole. But usually I get to a golf course a couple of days before Watson, especially if it's a course that he's never played on or I've never seen, and you walk the course over and over again. You walk it two or three times and you do your own measurements and you make your own little notes on the book so that, you know, any kind of question. He hits the ball on the rough. He can't reach the green. There's a bunker 50 yards short of the green. There was no reason you'd ever know what that is, but he'll want to know how far it is short to that bunker because he wants to lay up because he can't reach the green. So he'll say, what is it short of that bunker? I mean, those kinds of things you have to know if you're going to be a caddy at the level where these guys can hit it.
You've done this for many years as an avocation, as a hobby. Guys who do this for a living, I mean, do they go from town to town and share six guys to a hotel room?
No, it's not. When we started, there were sort of three kind of people who caddied on the tour. There were kind of the old tour caddies who were the kind of characters that you'd read about who were real gypsies. The other caddies who came out to caddy were African-American men who caddied at Augusta. Most people don't know that the Augusta National Golf Club, where the Masters is held every year, closes shortly after the Masters in April and doesn't reopen again until the fall. So those caddies would come out on the golf tour. And then there were young guys like me who were kind of the first generation of college kids who came out and caddied. When you were making no money, and we'd have four or six guys stay in a hotel room. We'd literally get in a hotel room, usually four of us. We'd stay in a Days Inn or a Holiday Inn or a Motel 6. I never caddied on tour when a Motel 6 was $6.99 a night, but I did when it was $8.99 a night. And we'd separate the box spring and the mattresses. And we put a sheet on top of the box springs, and four of us would stay in a hotel room that would be maybe $3 a night. That's when the average total purse of a golf tournament was $150,000. Now the average purse on the PGA Tour is between $6 and $8 million. The PGA, one of the four majors, just happened, was $10 million. And the purses are larger. Caddies are not making $125 a week. I would guess that the average caddy's salary is $1,500 a week plus, you know, 5 to 10% of what a player wins. And if you have the top 100, 150 player on tour, you're probably making close to $200,000 a year. So you're not staying six in a hotel room anymore. It's a real profession.
You clearly don't do this, don't need to do this. Why do you keep caddying?
Because by far it's the most fun thing I've ever done. I love golf. My real friends in life are people that I grew up with on the golf tour starting when I was a late teenager, when I was 19 years old. I mean, these are people that I've known for four. I mean, I've known Tom Watson since 1972. I've known Annie North since 1973. I mean, you know, I grew up with the Nicholases. I mean, these are people that I've grown up with literally for 40 years. They've watched me go through school and, you know, now that I'm, you know, older. But the tour was much smaller, much more intimate. Everybody knew each other then. And, you know, I know there are 40 or 50 guys that I know who are still playing on the senior tour who, you know, I've caddied for, have been around, plus a lot of caddies who are still around and a lot of reporters and people who are still around the game. It was before the world of the Golf Channel, but it was a lot of fun.
Neil Oxman, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Dave.
Good to talk to you.
Neil Oxman is a campaign media consultant and the co-founder of the Campaign Group. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is also senior news reporter at WHYY. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the New Pornographers, whose members include Nico Case. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The chief songwriter for the Canadian-based rock band The New Pornographers, A.C. Newman, calls the band's new album, Brill Bruisers, a celebration record. He's quoted as saying, "After periods of difficulty, I'm at a place where nothing in my life is dragging me down, and the music reflects that." Rock critic Ken Tucker listened to Brill Bruisers to figure out what Newman meant.
The eight members of the New Pornographers have each conducted separate careers. For example, singer-songwriter Nico Case works as a solo artist, and singer-guitarist Dan Behar has his band Destroyer. But under the guidance of ad hoc leader Alan Carl A.C. Newman, the New Pornographers combine to form something much different than the sum of its parts. In the case of this album, Brill Bruisers, it's a collection of lushly arranged and harmonized pop. For all the straightforwardness of the music, Newman has a fondness for teasingly elliptical lyrics. I cheerfully admit I don't know what the lyric of Fantasy Fools means, but the music, especially as it barrels into the chorus, communicates a happiness that I find exhilarating no matter how many times I play it. Here come the fortune seekers. The backyard dreams of be their secrets. The fortune seekers. As you can hear from that song, the New Pornographers is making music whose influences are fun to figure out. I hear some ABBA in the harmonies, some ELO in the keyboards. On other songs, there's everything from the playful, pompous rock of Queen to the soulful harmonies of the Mamas and the Papas, emanating from the contributions of strong vocalist Catherine Calder, among others. Which means, ultimately, that this band is creating its own sound, using the time-tested pop culture method of picking and choosing from anything and everything, recombined for original effects. Last night I dreamt Vancouver dressed up in the ocean. Last night I dreamt Victoria drowned in the ocean, the ride of a lifetime.
the rights of spring of a lifetime, the right of a lifetime, the rights of spring of a lifetime.
If you separate out the individual members of this band, each has made his or her share of moody, morose, even despairing music. Indeed, it has sometimes seemed as though the voice of Nico Case, low and rumbling, was made for conjuring up melancholy. But there's a brightness and light that emanates from these musicians when they become the New Pornographers. Although Newman does most of the songwriting on Brill Bruisers, the working out of the arrangements and each song's instrumental effects comes across as very much collaborative efforts, whether they are or not. The result is a band in harmony in every sense. One thing that the title song suggests is that the band is using Brill in the British slang manner, as short for brilliant. A.C. Newman also wants you to make the association with the Brill Building, the Manhattan edifice that housed famous songwriting teams in the 60s. The band is even going to give a concert in the lobby of that building to promote this album. But the brilliant bruisers cited in the song's lyrics are stand-ins for the group members themselves. Music industry pros who take pride in a muscular professionalism, in being prolific and, when need be, pugnacious. It's what gives a song such as Backstairs a real punch.
Before I knew to choose the music of celebrity, I sang backups on the backstairs.
So to circle back to A.C. Newman's declaration that Brill Bruisers is a celebration record, well, yes, there's a frequently thrilling exuberance to the music here, the satisfaction to be savored of a band having worked hard over the course of 2 years to make the full flowering of any given song sound like spontaneous growth, which is just one measure of the growth of the band itself, a maturity that is confident enough to make capturing the sound of immature joy sound like the art it is.
Ken Tucker reviewed The Brill Bruisers, the latest album from the New Pornographers. Coming up, book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Ben Lerner's new novel, 1004, which she describes as brilliant. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of Ben Lerner's new novel, 1004. His 2011 novel, Leaving the Atocha Station, was named a Best Book of the Year by, among others, The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, and The Boston Globe. Here's Maureen's review.
I admired Ben Lerner's last novel a lot. In fact, I ended my review of Leaving the Atocha Station by saying that reading it was unlike any other novel reading experience I've had for a long time. I could say the very same thing about Lerner's brilliant new novel called 1004, which leads me to wonder just how many singular reading experiences can one novelist serve up? And if every one of Lerner's novels is singular, doesn't that make them, in a way, repetitive? Those are the kind of flip philosophical ruminations that Lerner's writing encourages. He's self-conscious, funny, and smart. His riffs on everything from wisdom teeth extraction to the space shuttle Challenger disaster flash by your eyes with the urban fluidity of silverfish. Granted, as I did while reading Leaving the Atocha Station, I got a little exasperated here with Lerner. He indulges a smarty-pants tick of using hyperinflated language to describe the mundane, like when his anonymous narrator in 1004 announces that he's crying by telling us he's having a mild lacrimal event. Too much of that Mr. Spock dialect can be a turnoff. Fortunately, though, Lerner reins himself in as the novel progresses. 1004 is a mind-blowing book. To use Lerner's own description, it's a book that's written on the very edge of fiction. Now, if only I didn't have to try to explain what the book is about, because just like its title, the plot of 1004 is way out of the box. Nevertheless, here goes. Our unnamed narrator, who intersects with Ben Lerner himself, has gotten a huge advance to write his second novel on the strength of a story he's published in The New Yorker. When 1004 opens, our narrator and his agent are celebrating at an expensive restaurant in Manhattan. There, they ingest baby octopuses that have been literally massaged to death by the chef. Our narrator tells his agent that he plans to expand his story into a novel by projecting myself into several futures simultaneously, by working my way from irony to sincerity in the sinking city. That, of course, is also an overview of 1004 itself, the hyper-aware novel Lerner writes for us. Bookended by two historic hurricanes that threatened New York City, Hurricane Irene and Hurricane Sandy, 1004 projects our narrator into several possible plot lines. For instance, he receives a diagnosis of a serious aortic heart valve problem, as he also consents to be the sperm donor for a close friend who yearns to have a baby, while he also leaves town for a writer's retreat in Texas. Lerner's dazzling writing connects and collapses all these storylines into one. Here, for instance, is a snippet where our narrator describes New York City girding for Hurricane Irene. Note how octopi and aortas swirl into the hurricane update in this passage. From a million media, most of them handheld, awareness of the storm seeped into the city, entering the architecture and inflecting traffic patterns. I mean, the city was becoming one organism, constituting itself in relation to a threat viewable from space, an aerial sea monster with a single centered eye around which tentacular rain bands swelled. There were myriad apps to track it, the same technology they'd utilized to measure the velocity of blood flow through my arteries. Bravo! Lerner obviously loves playing with language, stretching sentences out, folding them in on themselves, and making readers laugh out loud with the unexpected turns his paragraphs take. This is a more ambitious novel than Leaving the Atocha Station in that Lerner, as his narrator tells his literary agent in that opening scene, does work his way from irony to sincerity in the sinking city. The final scene of this novel, where our narrator and his pregnant close friend walk through a blacked-out lower Manhattan as Hurricane Sandy bears down, is as beautiful and moving as any of the tributes to New York written by other famous literary walkers in the city, like Walt Whitman and Alfred Kazin, who are presiding presences here. 1004 is a strange and spectacular novel. Don't even worry about classifying it. Just let Lerner's language sweep you off your feet.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed 1004 by Ben Lerner. Maureen has a new book of her own about to be published called So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. I'm going to talk with her about it on our show next Monday. There's still time to read The Great Gatsby before the interview. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Florida Power and Light combines solar and natural gas to generate electricity 24 hours a day. Thinkaboutit.org. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, with 25 years of Kids Count data on the well-being of America's children, at datacenter.kidscount.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The two journalists beheaded by ISIS were dressed in orange, like the jumpsuits some detainees in Gitmo are required to wear. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times reporter Charlie Savage, who has reported extensively about Gitmo and was there in August. This week, he reported on how Gitmo is decaying and why it's been so difficult to close. Join us.